Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we start the show by talking about the book Canary Girls. It's the story of the British women who risked their lives to make ammunition for World War I. And in the studio with me, back once again, Jennifer Cheverini. She's the New York Times bestselling author of a number of historical novels. Switchboard Soldiers comes to mind. Resistance Women comes to mind. But there have been many of them. And as we talk with her today, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you had a relative or a friend who worked in a factory during the war times. What do you want to know about the, I think, courageous lives of the people who lived and worked in those kind of situations during the war? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So Canary Girls, who are the main characters of your book, they aren't famous at all here in the U.S. I didn't know a thing about Canary Girls until I read your book. Who were the Canary Girls?
Well, the Canary Girls were a group of munitionettes, and those were the women who filled in for the men in the factories making bombs, shells, aircraft, and all the other material of war in the UK during World War I. It was when Great Britain went to war, all the men took up arms. They enlisted in great numbers, and the materials still needed to be manufactured. So the plant owners and the businessmen had no choice but to very reluctantly hire women to fill all of these vacant positions because there just weren't enough able-bodied men around. Now, some of these jobs were protected war work, so the men didn't have to go overseas, but a lot of them were just completely vacant. So during a time called the Shell Crisis, when it looked like Britain would not have enough weapons to be able to continue fighting, a big push was made to increase production, turn factories that had been put to civilian uses earlier and transfer those over to war production. And to fill all of these vacant positions, they made great recruitment drives to get women this big untapped pool of laborers from the homes and from the domestic areas into these jobs. And the saying was, be the girl behind the man behind the gun. And posters were set up that said, on her, their lives depend. And so it was really this opportunity for women to do the essential work, but also to serve their country in this time of crisis. Now, these women were all, as a group, given the name munitionettes, but the Canary Girls were a smaller group within this larger pool. And some of the women, they all did essential labor, but some of them were working with explosive materials, TNT, or they called it the yellow powder. And
this, in the danger building, I think they called
it. Yes, they were called the danger buildings, and with good reasons. I mean, there are dangers inherent in the manufacture of explosives when they're working with this explosive powder, filling shells and everything else. They had to take so many precautions to try to reduce the risk of a fire or an explosion. They were not allowed to wear silk. They were not allowed to wear any metal at all. They had to wear wooden clogs, anything that they could do to reduce the fatal spark that might set the entire factory ablaze, right, or level it. And this did happen. But in addition to the danger of the explosion or fire, something that they were not aware of as much in the beginning of the war was that this TNT was highly toxic. And it wasn't until the war went on and there were more women exposed in greater numbers and more intimately with the TNT did they begin to realize there was really something very wrong here. The women who worked with filling the shells and other things dealing with the TNT, they began to complain of a number of very strange symptoms, from a metallic taste in the mouth to terrible stomach ailments and bad migraines and soreness in their breasts and elsewhere in the body.
And turning yellow.
And that was the one that was the most obvious. Their skin took on, over time, a lurid yellow hue. And at first they thought it was purely cosmetic. You know, you're working with a yellow powder. Oh, yeah, you're getting it on yourself, and it's making your skin turn yellow. And, of course, a lot of cosmetics manufacturers saw this as a great advertising opportunity. Oh, buy this skin moisturizer. It will keep your skin from turning yellow. But it didn't work because it wasn't simply a matter of having the powder on the skin. It was a symptom of toxic jaundice and other organ damage. But it wasn't until some time had gone by and women were calling in sick or fainting on the job. And in some serious cases, some of these women gave birth to yellow-skinned infants that the medical profession got involved and began doing some studies. And they realized that, you know, these canary girls, as we fondly call them, in tribute to the dangerous work they're doing, they are actually risking not only their health but their very lives to create the materials needed to win the war.
You know, one thing I love about your books are novels, but what you just described actually happened. I mean, your novels are always very fact-based.
Yes, and my readers tell me that they really like that.
I love that.
You know, they like it that they, of course, I'm prone to error like every other human being, and sometimes I do have to take some poetic license with, you know, conflating some characters or creating entirely new characters, as I've done with Canary Girls. But I know that my readers like to know that, you know, maybe since my fictional narrators didn't exist, okay, so maybe it didn't happen exactly this way, but it could have happened this way. I do try to follow the historical timeline and to get my scientific facts right and my historical facts right, because I know that's something that my readers tell me they really appreciate about my books.
Yeah, well, I certainly do, and I'm sure others, as you say, others have expressed that as well. And this novel shifts perspectives among three women, and maybe we could talk a little about those characters, and let's go with Lucy maybe to start with, and kind of what was her life like.
Yeah, and I wanted to include three different narrators because the women who were drawn to this war work, the women who wanted to do their bit, they came from all different classes and they had all different backgrounds. And ordinarily, they probably would not ever have crossed paths, and they probably would not have met. And Lucy is she's a fictional character inspired by real women, but she is in her early 30s, and she's a mother, or her late 20s, and she's the mother of two sons, and she is the wife of a professional football or soccer player, as we say here in the U.S. And so she has she has a very interesting life, but once the war started up and there were these vast recruitment drives, there was this move to create what were called PALS battalions, so that you weren't, when you enlisted, you weren't put in with a bunch of fellows you didn't know, but you were with a group of people, either you were from the same village or you were from the same profession. There was a stockbroker's battalion, for example. But Lucy's husband joined the footballers' battalion. There was this move to get these, you know, healthy, vigorous, athletic, very fit men to take up arms and serve their country. So Lucy had this lovely domestic life that she enjoyed so much with her loving husband and her two wonderful boys. But then her husband went off to war, and his salary or his wages as a soldier were not quite the same. And she wanted to do whatever she could to get him home as soon as possible. So she decided to take up war work to serve her country and to hasten the end of the war to get him home.
And she wound up in the ammunition factory.
She did. She was one of them who took on additional training. So some women, they went straight to the factories, and they had a physical, and they had an interview, and then they were put to work wherever it seemed their skills best suited them. But what Lucy did, and what a number of other women did, was that they went in for a training course to get special technical skills and on a variety of different tools and machinery. And what that would generally lead to would be a more prestigious position and something with higher wages. So Lucy decided to take it from that angle.
Yeah. And then there was, and by the way, with Lucy, I found that interesting. You talk about how many people were angry because those footballers weren't going to play. And it reminded me of another author who wrote about World War II. With the football teams, professional teams back at that time, were kind of forced maybe to join in.
Yes, there was a lot of public pressure because some people just thought it was absolutely disgraceful that these healthy, able-bodied men would be out playing a game while other men were losing their lives, sacrificing their lives on the battlefield. But this actually did become a class issue because while, you know, various members of parliament and people in the press were denouncing those footballers for not signing up, they weren't saying the same thing about polo players or cricket players.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said, well, this is because football was the working man's game.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a different expectation. They needed to go out there and fight, but, you know, all of the upper crust men playing cricket, well, you know, we're not going to put the same pressure on them. But there was a lot of, you know, peer pressure, public pressure for these footballers to get out there and do their bit.
Oh. And then we have April, another of the, and she was a housemaid at the beginning of the book, which I wondered, you must have done some work about some research on housemaids, but I thought, oh my goodness, what a life.
Oh, it was absolute toil. It was difficult.
3:34 in the morning.
Absolutely. You're up before dawn and you don't go to bed until well after sunset when the family is all taken care of. And this was with April was a fortunate housemaid in the sense that she was in a very nice, comfortable home, and she was one of many on a staff. She wasn't responsible for everything on her own. But April is is the youngest of my narrators. She's still a teenager, and she's quite young when she goes to accept this job as a housemaid at this country estate. And there, they worked incredibly long hours doing everything on your knees, scrubbing floors, sweeping, cleaning, dusting, setting the fires, and having to be pretty much invisible when you do it. And the wages were not good. And the living conditions also were not. And, you know, and April had one of the better positions. So what was interesting for April and other people in domestic service was that all of a sudden, all these new jobs are open to women, and the work hours, as difficult as this factory labor was, the working hours were actually much better. You know, so for some women, it would be, oh my gosh, we have to get up so early to begin our shift. For housemaids like April, it was, wow, we get to sleep in. This is great. And so not only were the working hours, and yes, the work was considerably more dangerous, but the working hours were better. The pay was several times what they would make in domestic service. And working as a munitionette, working as a canary girl, had a level of prestige and respect that being a housemaid did not. There were, of course, some people who were absolutely horrified by the idea of women working in factories. They thought this was going to absolutely just overturn society. It was against the natural order for women to be doing this sort of work. But for the most part, people were very grateful for the women who were willing to step in and do this work because it was so essential. And they gave a lot of respect to the women who did this job. There were songs written about them, and the name Canary Girls, while it might seem derogatory, it was actually a term of endearment. It was a fond nickname to recognize, because they were very recognizable with their yellow skin, but it was meant to, like, oh, there's one of those brave lasses doing this work so that the boys will be able to fight and come home.
Our guest today, Jennifer Cheverini, and her latest book is titled Canary Girls. Hope you join in with your questions or comments as we move along. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today, and Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, her book, Canary Girls, and it's a story of women who worked as munitionettes.
That's right.
Munitionettes during World War I in England. A fascinating story. And we were talking about April, who is one of the main characters in the book. And a friend of hers, I think you used a friend of hers, Marjorie, to kind of bring up the patriotism part of it a bit more. And patriotism played a big role in the lives of these British people, women and men. But the white feather came up. And I wondered if that was an actual thing.
Oh yes, the League of the White Feather, the White Feather. They, this was another measure that was meant to try to get the boys, the young men, to enlist. And the idea behind the White Feather was, it was said that a cockerel with a white feather in its tail was always a coward in fighting, in cockfighting. So that. It became, young ladies were asked to, if they saw a young man lolling about, you know, idly, who looked like he ought to be in uniform, the idea was to shame him into enlisting by publicly giving him a white feather to tell him, essentially, that he was a coward and he ought to be fighting like all the brave Tommies who are already over there. And so Marjorie, April's friend, she's a little bit older, quite a bit more headstrong. She has brothers who are over there fighting already. And so she takes it upon herself to join the League of the White Feather and start distributing white feathers to anybody that she thinks ought to be over there fighting like her brothers are. And there's so many problems with that. And April mentions some of them. I mean, if someone really, really doesn't have it in him to fight, he should probably be doing something else. You know, he should be contributing in some other way. And also, Marjorie just makes mistakes. You know, she tried to give one to a teenager and who just was not even old enough to go. But it was this extra element of peer pressure that did, in fact, drive some young men who otherwise would not have enlisted into enlisting and going overseas, and many of them did lose their lives because of it.
Yeah. Well, Helen's the final main character. So we had Lucy, April, and Helen. She's introduced as a suffragette.
Yes.
And so there are some stories in there that reminded me of other books that you've...
Yes, I've written about, I'm so fascinated by all the suffragettes and suffragists. And yes, Helen is among them. And Helen is in an interesting position because she is Anglo-German. Her mother is British, but her father is German, and he's a professor of classics at Oxford. So she speaks German fluently, and she feels very at home in both of these worlds, although, of course, she's British to the core. But then the war breaks out between her late father's country and her own homeland, and that puts her in this unusual position because there were measures taken against enemy aliens, as German people who were living in Britain at the time were called, and even immigrants who had gotten citizenship. They had a lot of their freedoms taken away, a lot of their former rights that they had enjoyed up until this point taken away. And so there was a lot of pressure on immigrants from Germany and first-generation Anglo-German people to enlist to prove their patriotism. And of course, we saw that here in the U.S. as well during the First World War and also in the Second World War, too. We, you know, people of German ancestry, people of Japanese ancestry really felt the pressure to enlist to just to prove that we are Americans. And the same thing was going on in the U.K. in World War One. So she's in this position when the war breaks out. But even before that, she was fighting for civil rights. She was fighting for women's rights in the suffragette movement. And she was involved in a lot of the marches onto Parliament to try to fight for women to get the right to vote. And she was very much involved in this almost up until wartime. She married, and she began to have concerns when the UK suffrage movement began, sending mail bombs and planting a bomb under the coronation chair in Westminster. And so she began to want to depart from that more militant standpoint. So, but she still, her heart was still with the suffrage movement, even after she married and kind of moved away from the day-to-day marching.
And her husband turned the family business, I think, was it a sewing machine company? I've forgotten now.
Yes, it was. It was defunct by the time the war started, but he is a reluctant munitions manufacturer. He, Arthur, wanted to be a scholar. And in fact, that's how they met. He was a student of her father's, but then he was, she didn't realize just how wealthy he was at the time. She was more interested. She didn't want to marry. She just wanted to study the classics with her father. But when eventually his father said, okay, you've indulged your education enough. It's time for you to come and work for the family business. And so he was in charge of, running some of the various factories. And when the shell crisis happened and all of these other factories were turned from domestic manufacturing to wartime production, he was put in charge of one of these munitions plants. And it was work that he took on out of duty, not only to his family, but of course to his country as well. But Arthur, he was not he did not have a hawk-like spirit. He was not a warmonger. He wanted to, he wanted to be a scholar, and he wanted to focus on the life of the mind. And he was required to instead turn to these terribly destructive weapons and to devote himself to creating all of the munitions that he knew took lives. And it took its toll on his mental health, knowing that he was, even as London was being bombed, he knew that he was responsible for the same thing happening to German civilians. And that really took its toll on him.
I was thought of as kind of as a little aside that they left the sign of the company up, the sewing machines banner, because they didn't want to advertise that they were a munitions plant.
Absolutely. Now, I'm not sure realistically how convincing that ruse would be, especially when you see canary girls walking out of the sewing machine factory. But yes, there is, they try to disguise the locations of these various munitions factories as best they could from spies and, of course, from the dirigibles and later the airplanes that would fly overhead and try to bomb the factories. And that was one of the reasons, in order to keep these locations secret and keep the work that they were doing secret, was when an accident did happen, because it was, unfortunately, in many ways, unavoidable. It was inevitable that there would be workplace accidents, some of them very serious, that they had to do their best to keep it out of the newspapers. So, you know, sometimes they would not announce if an accident happened and many people lost their lives in an explosion. They had to keep it out of the press. Even obituaries were not allowed to say that a particular person died in an explosion on the job, even though the families knew that this person gave their life in war service and deserved to be honored for that. It wasn't something that was supposed to be in the papers or even talked about, because nothing that would hearten the enemy could be in the papers, and nothing that gave away locations of where this war production was going on could be spoken about. So it wasn't until long after the war that some of the women and men, too, who lost their lives in these workplace accidents were able to be honored for the contributions and the sacrifices that they made.
You know, you had the manager telling April, describing for April, I think it was, here's your job. But then in that process, you're describing how a shell is made. And in a little detail, but enough for me to think, how many, we've got thousands of women out here, people putting these together. And the amount of how exacting things had to be.
Absolutely.
And if just one mistake.
Right. One mistake could result in disaster in the factory, but of course also on the battlefield.
Yeah. Of course. I want to be sure we get into the part about soccer and women. They played soccer as a way to maybe to shake off stress. At first,
absolutely,
I thought that was going to be just a really minor mention in the book, but it turned out to be more.
Yeah, it was really something that drew together these three women in particular in my novel, because they came from all different classes, but they were united in, you know, their love for the sport. But I also just thought it was, when I was doing my research and I learned about the girl footballers, as they were called, I was just so fascinated by this. So not only did the women fill in for the men in the factories and in all these, you know, in the railroads and in the postal service, they filled in for the men everywhere, they also filled in for them on the football pitch. And it was because essentially professional football, professional soccer, was essentially shut down for the war because it was considered disgraceful to be playing a game when people are losing their lives. Now, there were charity matches and veterans who returned. They would play exhibition matches. But for the most part, it wasn't happening. So women took to the football pitches too, and a league even evolved. And ordinarily, or typically how this started up, were just recreational teams in the workplace. So during their breaks or after hours, they might all get out there on the field on their workplace grounds or nearby and just kick the ball around a little bit, maybe play a friendly just amongst themselves. But women had been playing soccer since the late 1800s, but not on a wide scale. There weren't really many organized leagues. It was not considered a suitable pastime for women. It was considered too rough, too exhausting, and girls just weren't supposed to play football. But women did, in these recreational leagues just at the workplace. And then when they found out, you know, oh, the factory across town also has a team, then they began challenging each other to matches. And then that just grew and spread as interest sparked from one factory to another, and it grew up all over. And so then the women began playing matches more formally in what they called the Munitionettes League. Sometimes the football pitches had been turned over to war use. They were campgrounds, parade grounds, drilling grounds, but some of them remained open. And so the women, they weren't being used for the men's leagues, so the women would go and they would play, and they would use the gate, they would use the ticket sales to go to various charities. Sometimes it would be to help returning veterans. Sometimes it would be to help widows and orphans. So it was considered, okay, ordinarily we wouldn't want women to be exerting themselves this way, but it's fun, they're enjoying it, and it's for a good cause, so we'll allow it. But then when people began coming to see these matches, you know, they first went because they thought, oh, this will be amusing. Let's see the girls try to play this sport. But then they were actually
pretty good.
Really good. There were high athleticism out there, and people were like, this is actually really fun and this is exciting. And certain players were so skilled that they began to acquire fans and a following, and the newspapers began covering these matches. Now, sometimes it was kind of condescending. They would like spend more time talking about the comparative beauty of the players as opposed to their athleticism, which, you know, the women found highly annoying, but, you know, it spread the word about their games, and it got people in, and it gave them a chance to play. And that's really what they wanted to do.
And they actually had some pretty big crowds.
They did draw big crowds. And so then more people became aware that, you know, not more authorities became aware that not only is this raising money for all these very deserving charities, so it's helping out with the war effort in that regard, it is also helping boost morale. Because it's keeping spirits up in this incredibly difficult time. It's taking people's minds off of the devastation and the losses that they're suffering, even if it's only for, you know, 90 minutes at a time. It's giving people something that's unifying and inspiring and diverting in a time where they really did need something to help keep up morale.
Yeah. And why there's so much that we can still talk about relating to your book. One of the things I did want to talk about to mention was that near the end of the war, what was it, the British Women's Emigration Association or something like that?
Yes.
There was discussion about surplus women.
Yes,
which I thought,
what a phrase. Oh,
surplus,
my goodness.
Women. Was
surplus,
that the actual?
Women. That was the phrase that was used, yes. And you know, it kind of strikes us as shocking, but, you know, it was taken a little bit better back then, I guess. But, yes, I mean, an entire generation of young men had been lost. You know, so many young men of marriageable age had been lost to the war. And so there were all of these women. And it used to be, of course, there were always women who worked to support themselves and their families, not just during World War I. But for the most part, marriage was considered the way for a woman to be provided for. You know, she would grow up, she would learn domestic skills, she would get married, and her husband would provide for her. Well, now you have all of these women who are not going to be able to have that opportunity. There is not going to be a marriage and motherhood waiting for them. So there were questions about what to do with them. And so there was this move to ship them off to Australia or to Canada or elsewhere where they would have a better chance of finding that domestic arrangement. And, you know, with the men coming back near the end of the war, when they saw that the end was coming, the authorities, the government, had to start planning for their repatriation, bringing them back to the States. And the men were going to come back and resume their civilian lives. They were going to come back, and all of those, you know, the factories making munitions would be retooling, either shutting down or going back to domestic manufacturing. And the men were going to want and deserve their jobs back. You know, and the question was, well, what's going to happen to the women? The women thought, we have been here. We've been earning these wages. Good wages for many of them, the first time ever, for most of them, I would say. And they were expected to step aside and go back to their pre-war existence and just, you know, with a smile and graciously bow out so that the men could come back and take their jobs. And it was considered shameful for them to want to stay and work after everything the men had done to preserve their, you know, to keep them from being invaded by the Germans and to win the war. And some of the women were only in it for the wartime service. That was fine. They were doing this because it was essential. And then they wanted to go back and resume their ordinary lives. But other women had learned valuable skills. They had done an excellent job. And they wanted to keep that. They wanted to keep that for themselves. They wanted to be able to continue to provide for their families. But that was not the expectation of the factories or of society at large. They were expected to bow out gracefully and make way for the returning soldiers.
Lots more we can talk about relating to it. And I thought a really nice, which we won't go into, but a really nice wind-up to the book as well, which takes us kind of back to the football or the soccer pitch. I mean, you've got some, you're going to be out on the road a little bit for this. And by the way, tomorrow is the first day.
That's right. Yes.
Anybody can buy your book.
Right. That tomorrow, Tuesday, it will be the first official publication day of Canary Girls. So I'm really excited. I'm going to be celebrating that with a lot of local readers and friends at Mystery to Me here in Madison at 6 p.m. tomorrow, Tuesday. And then I'll be visiting other places around Wisconsin. I'll be at the Wauwatosa Public Library on Wednesday. And then the following week, I'll be in Oconomowoc at the Oconomowoc Public Library. And then in Kenosha, I'll be, the following week after that, I'll be at Blue House Books in Kenosha, a wonderful independent bookstore. I'm so looking forward to visiting them. And also the other events are going to be supported by Books and Company from Oconomowoc and Boswell Books out of Milwaukee. So it's going to be a lot of lovely libraries and independent bookstores, and most of them right here in Wisconsin.
Always a pleasure, Jennifer. And your books are so great. I've loved every one of them, and we've been doing this a long time together, and I so much appreciate it. I've learned so many things through reading your books about the interesting things that I keep saying, why didn't I know about Canary Girls, or why didn't I know about some of the other women you've written about? And so it's been a real pleasure, and you'll have another book.
Yes, I'll have another book out in April, and just in time for the 25th anniversary of the Elm Creek Quilt Series, I'll have another Elm Creek Quilts novel out there for all of those fans who have been asking me, when are you going to get to see your quilting friends again? The answer is April 30th. So I'll be back in the spring with another Elm Creek Quilts novel.
And we'll have you back.
That'd be great.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, and her book is... it's a great book. It's called Canary Girls, the story of British women who risked their lives to make ammunition for World War I. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at what is happening around Wisconsin. The editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine, Mike Beano, back with us tomorrow. Coming up, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.